The microphone's on now. Thank you. When we left Justice Prosser here, does he wanted to talk with you? So he's up first.
Question number one. I view you as one of the consummate professionals in the state, irrespective of this particular ethical field. I think you're spectacular. And I think that you would be thinking about when to exercise substitutions against a referee. How frequent is it in your perception that other respondents and their attorneys exercise substitution rights?
Thank you, Justice. I think there are two components to it. The first one is in many, many cases, the attorney is representing himself or herself. And in those instances, they're not necessarily thinking trial strategy. They're dealing with anger. And I would say that they would not even think about that right. I've also read, I've never talked to anyone, but I've certainly read what I think were instances where the substitution process was used to delay a proceeding. And that troubles me as well. From my perspective, because I don't necessarily know who would be substituted in, I want to take a real hard look at who has been assigned before I would make that call. So there's not that great incentive for the substitution other than the delay of the process.
For one reason or another, my attention has been directed to substitutions by the OLR itself, much more than substitutions by respondents. What do you think motivates the OLR to substitute against a referee?
Well, I have not had one of those cases occur on proceedings that I've been involved in. And I would speculate that there have been cases where individuals have served as referee and they didn't quite see the issues from an ethics rules perspective. They may very well have seen the issues from their view of what's right or what's, you know, appropriate or what should have, what the lawyer did or didn't do from a perspective of the business and that type of thing. And I think there are some instances that I've had some contact with where, again, I don't think the referee necessarily understands the, I use the word language, and I don't necessarily mean just the language. It's the analysis that you go through determining whether or not there has been some sort of a violation or whether you have pushed the envelope beyond what's reasonable. It's a very confined system. And frankly, my concern would be if those are the people making the decisions, that creates some dangerous precedent too. And I know that the OLR looks at precedent. I'm certain this court looks at precedent. So I want some level of comfort and confidence that the analysis is being done from the right perspective because it creates a significant precedent down the road.
Okay. The Chief Justice has suggested that somehow we initiate a process for reviewing OLR, the totality of OLR. And I thought I understood from her comments that she was suggesting that sort of equivalent professionals from other states, objective equivalent professionals, come in. Would you see that as the sole kind of person who would be involved in an objective or would it, would the best kind of study involve a broader perspective?
I'm sure it doesn't surprise anyone on the bench that I anticipated that question. And that is the absolute most difficult question for me to ask. And what I'm really saying to you is, it is very hard for me to take off the hat of an advocate and put on the hat of a member of the bar looking to improve the profession and the procedure, which will improve the profession. I'd like to think I can do that, but boy, is that hard to do. I mean, I have some, you know, if you keep me in an advocate's role, I have some very strong opinions on the process. I don't think those opinions are based upon a reasoned looking at the process. And you heard me say, and I will stand by it, that I think, generally speaking, when you really back away and look at it, the process is not that bad. Sure, there's tweaking that can be done, but the process is not that bad. I spent a lot of time explaining that to the lawyer being investigated. But if I were just putting my advocate hat on, I'd have some other strong opinions that I've sometimes mistakenly said and gotten in trouble for. So I'm very protective right now.
Well,
I think that's a very fair answer. From my own perspective, that the advocate's point of view needs to be heard at some point. And there are, just as the Board of Governors of the State Bar has some citizen input, the people who would come with a different perspective on things. I think people with a different perspective, maybe not representing a particular interest, but a different perspective, would be very valuable in any kind of objective overview, review.
And the only positive thought I can give to you to my last answer is sometimes those of us as advocates get old enough that we don't necessarily care if we're going to get in trouble with the other side, and you might get some very honest explanations of how it looks from the other side. But it's very difficult because, you know, we have cases pending before them all the time.
I noticed you were sitting right next to Mr. Saleen. So
we get along just fine, as long as we don't argue about certain aspects of the procedure.
All right. Those are my questions, and I thank you very much for your answers.
Are there any other questions or comments? Well, I want to thank you for coming. This is not the first time, and I hope it's not the last time. You've been very generous with your time, not only with the OLR, but other issues that have come up in the court, and have been very forthright as to which hat you're wearing or not wearing, and it's a very much appreciated counsel. You might remember that the Rogan Committee that examined parts of the OLR proceeding were not people who were represented people, and in fact, there were non-lawyers on it. One was a professional administrator, that is, somebody who had administrated, who was a chief executive officer of a government agency, so was familiar with issues that are so involved, and I thought that was extremely helpful, and I understand your comments, and when we did the BAPR, we had a whole array of people from both the professional field on discipline as well as the bar, as well as non-lawyers. Someone always reminds us that there are over 1,000 complaints against lawyers and a very few complaints against non-lawyers who practice law, as you will remember.
Yes.
And again, thank you very much.
I thank you all for the opportunity to present today.
Could I ask one more question?
Yes, of course.
I asked Mr. Saleen about the percentage of times when the preliminary review committee approved the recommendation of the director, and you picked up on that. Were you surprised by that percentage?
I have at various times been in meetings and proceedings and activities where members of the preliminary review committee have also been in attendance, and we've bantered about things and talked about things. And I, in my heart of hearts, I know that they are doing what they think is right. I know they are getting a tremendous amount of paperwork. So for them, you know, do I feel confident that if I've submitted something to the preliminary review committee that they've given it the weight of analysis as they've given to other documents that have come from OLR? Again, I know they are doing the job to the best of their abilities, but the amount of information is huge. I would also feel that the investigators, when they present something to the preliminary review committee, have weeded out many of the complaints that don't have sufficient merit. But I also have cases where it went to the preliminary review committee, charges were filed, and I'm to this day saying, why were charges brought on this? So I don't feel 100% comfortable with that process because of that.
I'm sorry. Are you done? One of the points made in other jurisdictions is that there is much less given to the review committee.
Mm-hmm.
That in this process, we have immense investigation before it goes to the preliminary review committee, and enormous amounts of papers go to them. Mm-hmm. And all they're doing is finding probable cause, which, as you know, is a very low burden. Now, it's probable cause added to clear and convincing, but it's still, compared to many things, a low burden.
But I would offer,
yes, that's
Chief
why
Justice,
I'm raising this issue with you.
I would offer to you that while the standard is a low standard, the consequences of the meeting of that standard
is significant.
Is significant, and there is no ability to negotiate. There's no ability. Yes, as Mr. Saleen has said, Executive Director Saleen has said, if some new pieces of information come in that you could now go to prosecuting attorney and show that information and get something changed or dismissed. Yes, I've been able to have that happen on occasion. But that's a very, very difficult process, a very hard process. So, you know, in effect, that's your only chance. Because once the preliminary review committee makes their decision, the case goes forward, and then arguably there's no ability to work within those charges.
And I heard you loud and clear on that. As Keith Saleen said, an ability to deal with plea bargains, et cetera. And in the Colorado system, at least as I understood it, there was much more ability to negotiate. Mm-hmm. Now, doesn't mean I'm right in what I just told you, because I obviously don't know that system, but it was prevalent. I'm going to tell you that since I signed the substitution material, I haven't kept count and have never asked for count. It's very few. Now, I don't know whether it's 10% or less or more, but of the number, that's my impression. And Mr. Saleen will be asked that on his next appearance.
But if there's
the
a panel of 10,
yeah, I understand.
And I know those, and I know who those 10 are,
yeah,
and I know this particular referee is not someone that I think is right for this case, I actually might feel more comfortable with the substitution.
And I did want to say, because it was raised, Referee Volke did resign from the panel. I just wanted to make that clear. I also wanted to make clear our use of terminology here, not yours, but everyone's. The panel, that is all 32, passed muster with the court. The attorney selected for any particular case, that selection is done in the clerk's office so that I am out of, you know, selecting judges or referees, et cetera. I appoint someone selected through the clerk's office, and they do it geographically. How many outstanding matters does this referee have at any particular time? Can the referee take the case, et cetera, et cetera? So just want to make those things clear.
And I'm not sure why it was brought up, but my impression from his letter is that referee Volke took himself off the list after he was no longer appointed to cases after 2011. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Schweitzer, do you want Judge Kenney?
Thank you, Schweitzer, and thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson and Justices. I wasn't really planning to do this. I read the proposed rule when it came out a few weeks ago, but then I scheduled an OLR hearing yesterday in Appleton, and I thought since I was that far down, come to complete the trip, and I was intending simply to appear here and listen to the proceedings, but as things have developed, I thought maybe I could add my two cents briefly. I think that the motive behind the proposed change, it seems to me, is to elevate the level of professionalism among referees, and I think that's an entirely laudable motive, but I think that there's another alternative that really should be considered first, and that is one that's already been referred to, I think, by Justice Bradley, and that is education or training. When I began this work as a referee, and this is difficult work, and a lot of people wouldn't like to do this work, and there are days when I don't like to do this work, but somebody has to do this. And it's not real lucrative. It pays more, however, than judging mock trial. But it's work that has to be done, and it's very important work. But I think that training was very valuable to me. The last time the commissioners did the training was 3 years ago, which was right prior to my coming on board. And I thought it was very valuable. I thought the materials that were provided were extremely valuable, and I have referenced them on numerous occasions since receiving that training. Who should do this training? Well, the commissioners, I guess, have done it. They did it when I underwent the training. But I also think that thought should be given, just as judges train judges, to have referees train referees. You know, as I sit here today, I sit next to my old friend, John Schweitzer, adjunct at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Judge Murphy has taught at judicial education seminars forever, and has more recently.
I don't know.
Long.
Well, he's as old as dirt. We know that, but
we call him Melchizedek every once in a while.
So, I think that's a proposal that would not be particularly costly, and I think it should be given consideration. And I also think that what do I think should be taught? Well, not anything about specific cases, obviously, but there are a lot of provisions of the Supreme Court rules relating to attorney discipline which are vague or need changing, or they need
somebody to tell us how we're supposed to interpret them. Let me give you just one example. And it's one that I will frankly tell you, I hope I'm not talking out of school here, that nobody seems to follow this rule. And I'm really uncomfortable with that. But the fact is nobody follows it because it doesn't really make any sense the way it's written. And that is the very rule that talks about the time limits for the referee to do their job. And it's 22.16.6, and it says, within 30 days after the conclusion of the hearing or the filing of the hearing transcript, whichever is later, the referee shall file, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, in the context of contested hearing, we're going to have briefs. And before they even start writing their briefs, the attorneys want what? The transcript. So, you know, you get the transcript 2 weeks after the hearing, and then somebody has 30 days, and the other side has 30 days. And so it's what it needs to state. It needs to, first of all, recognize that there are briefs written post-hearing. And we aren't going to write our report and recommendation until we've reviewed the briefs. Secondly, if you don't want to use the word briefs, let's use the word that's referred to when we time the work that circuit judges do, when it's submitted in final form. That's really what should trigger the starting of the running of the clock for the referee. And I will also say that I think 30 days is a little ambitious, even with the times that I've talked about here. In the 50-count case that's contested, it is really ambitious, and it really requires us to scurry to do that in many cases. Now, not in the non-contested cases, not in the no-contest plea cases where maybe just sanction is left open or something, but in many other cases. Now, let me make a couple of other comments based on what I've heard here. And I really appreciate Dean Dietrich's remarks and his contrast between the strengths of reserve judges versus the strengths of private lawyers operating as referees. And I think he's onto something there. There's no question about it. But let me say that in my experience over the last 3 years, I have had many cases in which my familiarity with the law was a direct result of my having presided as a circuit judge for so many years. That is to say, I've had cases involving district attorneys. In fact, the first case that Dean and I had, which was a reinstatement case, involved child support. Now, believe me, I knew a lot more about child support, with all due respect, than Dean Dietrich did. Or, they don't do that at Ritterware, I understand. or the respondent himself. And that was very valuable. And so, in other words, the areas of the law that are frequently implicated by the filing of these complaints against attorneys are very frequently overlap very neatly with what I did for 31 years. Secondly, to also support the proposition that reserve judges make good referees, and I think any number of private practitioners make good referees for many of the reasons that he stated as well. But another reason is that there is a perception in some quarters that this whole system, and excuse my reference to gender, but that it's a good old boys network and process. And I think that the potential for it to be painted as such is greater when it's lawyers judging lawyers versus judges or reserve judges judging lawyers. Now, I think that's an unfortunate perception, but I think we go in with the perception that we are more neutral, that we have stood back a ways, that we're not, after this hearing, going to go back and do, the private practice of law, even though the private practice of law clearly gives referees who have been in private practice a leg up on questions such as trust accounts, conflicts of interest, things that, as a circuit judge, I didn't deal with, really. What would Bob Kinney do if the rule that's under consideration today were adopted? Well, that's really kind of a mixed bag. I like this work. I find it quite satisfying in many ways. But I don't want to be a full-time referee. If I wanted a full-time job, I would have stayed on the bench. So I wouldn't, it would be a interesting decision if I had to make it, but I think I would have to opt out because I don't want to work in a full-time job. Now, there was a mention by Justice Prosser of the disparity in compensation, kind of a minor disparity between referees on the one hand and prosecutors on the other, private prosecutors. That used to concern me somewhat. Not that a change in compensation for either group is going to result in the floodgates being open with people applying for these jobs, but simply I thought maybe out of equity it ought to be the same. But when you think of it, there is a rational basis for the disparity, and that has to do with the fact that the prosecutors almost universally, perhaps universally, are out of law offices. They are assisted by legal assistants who prepare a lot of this stuff, and that all has to be paid for. And I think perhaps this minor disparity may reflect that. The rest of us...
overhead, in other words.
Yes, exactly.
And you don't.
And I don't have any overhead. On the other hand, you know, Justice Prosser also expressed concern about, or maybe it was Justice Rogenczak, about, are you paying these people to do typing? In some cases, indeed, we are paying people to do typing, although I've kind of figured a way around that a little bit in the sense that I now frequently will ask prosecutors and defense counsel representing respondents as well to give me proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, so that at a minute, and whether I use any of their findings of fact or conclusions of law, you know what? I always use their footnotes with all those rules, which then I don't have to type. And that's a great saving in itself.
You know, well, you got this down pat.
Yeah, talk about efficiency.
Right.
Okay. I don't know if you have any questions of me based on my limited experience over the last 3 years. But
how many cases have you handled?
Yes.
How many cases have you handled? How many of them over 3 years, roughly?
I would say, I've had probably five that were just sign off on stipulations.
Right.
But I probably had another five that were contested, and then another three or four that were somewhere in between where there were pleas of no contest entered with respect to the charges, but then we'd have a brief sanctions hearing or something.
My recollection of how referees are paid was that we thought they were comparable in function to a judge, a reserve judge. And that's where the compensation was set, if I remember it. And we didn't want to pay a reserve judge in court more than maybe a reserve judge sitting as a referee because we didn't want them to choose one or the other and dealt with it. So as I remember, that's how it was picked. Now, of course, I am told, and I assume it's correct, that in many trial courts and maybe in this court, many times the lawyers who appear before us make more than the judge. So there's nothing new about that, is there?
No, and I'm not emphasizing that at all either. I just picked up on what Justice Prosser said, and I'm not here to lobby for a pay increase
referees. I understand that, but I'm trying to explain to you how
yes,
that was
and it
mad.
Makes complete sense when described that way.
And how it was done.
Judge Kenney, I've got a question.
Yes, Justice Crooks.
When I went through the materials that we were given, I counted 32 people that are presently acting as referees in one situation or another. Do you think that when we're talking about education and training, that it might be a wise idea to cut that list down at least somewhat?
I think so. There was the use of the word culling, I think, and I'm not sure
that's
who...
That's what we do in North Central Wisconsin.
Right.
Lincoln Limelight, you know.
Right, culling. Well, no, I think that's prudent. I mean, I assume that there are numbers of people on the list who probably haven't served in very many cases for years. And there may be some others who maybe shouldn't be serving anymore or for whatever reason should be culled out. Now, I don't know exactly who's going to do that on the basis of what standard they're going to use, but I think that probably would be appropriate. And especially if OLR has some concerns about the quality or whatever that's being done, I mean, they should have some input in that. But the defense lawyers who represent respondents should also have, I mean, if there's going to be any input from OLR, certainly it goes without saying that you've got to have input from the other side. I was somewhat surprised to learn that this proposal, which has been advanced by the OLR, has apparently been joined in, as I understand it, by the state bar. I would have thought that most of the lawyers who represent respondents would be more in line with Mr. Dietrich's position, which is that he sees problems with respect to, what, I don't know what you call it, coziness or something. I mean, when the same lawyers appear before the same referees, he's concerned about that. I think that's a legitimate concern. I don't think he would be the only defense lawyer in these attorney discipline proceedings who would have that concern, okay? So that's why I don't know if the individuals with the state bar who were responsible for putting their stamp of approval on this consulted with that rather small group of specialized practitioners who do respondent representation in these attorney disciplinary proceedings. But I would suspect that that group would not have favored this change, proposed change.
Well, we accept that the state bar has a board of our governors. It's representative of everybody, and that they need it. I think they need a large vote, more than a majority, if I have it right. 60% comes to mind, but I may be a little off, to come in and support a petition. And so, you know, most of the lawyers don't get before the OLR. And most of the, but all the lawyers contribute to the support of the OLR.
Right.
And the lawyers who get before the OLR don't like to pay the costs for one reason or other, and I understand that. And the rest of the lawyers think they should because they want their assessment to go down. So, you know, you have a unified bar, but it's not unified necessarily as to views on any particular issue, which may explain that. Do you still have a list, sir, the referees? They used to be, I may not have the right title. Or,
I know what you mean, and I'm unaware that there is.
A way of communicating, and so you're saying
right.
You're not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I have, we have overloads in across the system, and one overload is our own staff, our commissioners. And so they carry a heavy load on OLR matters and a heavy load on petitions for review and then a miscellaneous assortment of things. And to try and get out good opinions here, and as our procedures indicate, they do the initial draft of the OLR matters. I've been trying to think of ways in which we can reduce the workload, yet keep quality and keep the real decision here at the court where it belongs. And so I have suggested that perhaps opinions could be drafted where we accept findings of fact of the referee, where we accept the conclusions of law and the reasoning that we, you know, cite to and quote from the referee, which would be, it's easier than retyping everything, right? Okay, I learned that too. And so in doing that, the commissioners say, you know, they have a hard time doing that because the referees' reports are not uniformly excellent.
Yeah.
They may range from like butter, single A, double A, quadruple A, et cetera. And I never can remember whether prime or choice is better. Do you have any suggestions for us on that? And do you love our opinions, or you think we can improve those?
Or someplace in between.
Right.
Does he have a Fifth Amendment privilege?
Yeah, no.
He has the same
privilege as Mr. Celine and Mr. Diedrich.
I haven't given much thought to your former question, but I think that it would be helpful if the referees, like I say, they could involve themselves in an education program for referees, mm-hmm. free, you know. Mm-hmm. They do it free, and the education and the training would be free. Stepping back from that, certainly they should at least have a system of communication, I think. I think that could be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they're going to consult about the specific cases or answers to questions that may arise in specific cases, but general issues of statutory interpretation. You know, this rule that I just cited, literally applied, doesn't make sense. And so, you know, one of the tasks I do as a referee is the same task that I did as a circuit judge, which is part of the job, it seems to me, is when you have something that doesn't make sense, to try to interpret it, if you can, or apply it in a way that fixes the problem. But it's beyond the literal language, what everybody does, I'm telling you. So that needs to be fixed. There are other provisions that need to be fixed. And I think one of the proposals that's just come about may have come from the case that you and I had.
Mr. Kinney.
You wanted a stipulation accepted, and there wasn't any literal language to. But anyway.
Judge Kinney. We can't hear you when you talk to him.
I'm sorry.
So just summarize what you said.
Okay. Well, I don't. My issue was that there are other provisions here which, when you work through them in different specific cases, you find there are problems. There are literally problems. And I was surprised at the number of problems there were in the code, because I realize that much of this has been adopted from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, there are problems.
It's like any statute. It doesn't always cover every single issue.
Right.
And there are places for interpretation.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we can't do better. We can. All right. Any other questions? Comments? Thank you for appearing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for hearing me.
And I thank you for putting me on first, because now I can go back to Rhinelander and still get there while it's light out.
Right. So. Well, and thank you for your service as a referee. Mr. Schweitzer.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Justices. I don't oppose the petition as such, and I share OLR's and the court's concern in having the best referees available for handling cases. I don't think the changes proposed are necessary. And to summarize my comments, I think that better training and perhaps some communication about referees who are not up to the job with the commissioners or the court might solve the problem without having to create a new rule. I do have a couple of comments, and then as a referee, I am here to assist you in answering any questions you might like to put to me.
Noticed that they talk about trial lawyers or litigation lawyers. They talk about reserve judges. But you fit into the category, and probably you were a hearing examiner first.
Correct.
And then you got relabeled administrative law judge. Did your job change?
The job did not change, but after the federal government changed the titles to ALJ, some of the administrative agencies in Wisconsin made that change, and I benefited from a wonderful new title.
But an administrative law judge, a hearing examiner, whatever you want to call the person, presides over hearings. Some would have evidence apply, some not. But you have to control the proceedings, et cetera.
Right.
So don't you object that that's not listed as a potential referee?
If we were drafting the rule right now, I would want to make sure that people with my particular experience would be considered.
That you're one of our longest-standing referees, aren't you?
I think so. I've been on the panel for 20 years.
That's what I thought. In fact, you did at one time run a listserv. I may not be using the right
term. That was one of my comments. I wanted to respond to that. I do not know that it has gone out of existence, but it has withered away to the point where it has not been used.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps because we haven't had the training to reinforce to people
right.
that it is available. It's reached the point where a few people who used to be on listserv now contact me just directly with questions. But I think it
Which they did before we did the listserv.
Pardon me?
Which they did before we did the listserv. They
Correct.
Contacted you.
I think the listserv may still exist. We would have to resurrect it. And I would just point out, as far as ALJs go, I'm not here really to talk about my prior experience, but there are high-volume and low-volume ALJs at the Department of Regulation and Licensing. I held week-long hearings with attorneys on both sides and full evidence. Even though evidence is not following the evidence code was not required, we would get into that. But that's a completely different matter. I did want to mention, in response to one of Justice Prosser's questions, there are cases where I simply don't charge. I mean, if it's, you know, under a few hours, if it's just approving a private reprimand, I don't bother. I do see it as just something I'm doing to help out the court. And it's more trouble to me in the court if I submit a bill for 4 hours or something.
Thank you.
Also, I believe, Justice Abramson, you've made a comment about the OLR Oversight Committee, and I may be wrong, but I think that went out of existence two or 3 years ago.
Yeah, it may have been picked up by another committee.
Yes.
Same
I was
thought.
Sitting on it, and we did spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to mentor solo practitioners and get assistance actually out to people who needed to know about the rules of ethics. And I think they abolished or melded it into another committee. One or two other. I think those were the specific responses I had to your previous comments. I then just had one or two things I wanted to say on my own behalf. I do believe that training for referees would be a far more efficient way to achieve many of the purposes that Mr. Saline has had in submitting the petition. I don't think finance, it's not my impression that the finances really are a major issue here. We're talking about efficiency and quality, and I think if we simply teach the referees or get rid of the ones who aren't doing the job, and that may be a job for the court commissioners to help the clerk of courts cull the list, that's out of my hands, but I suggest that that would be a better approach. And my only other comment is that as a referee, personally, I've had approximately 2 cases a year assigned to me over those 20 years, so it's not been high volume at all. But I have always prided myself on getting the decisions in on time, within the 30 days, and providing a report that I think is not only going to reach a correct result legally, but that will present a platform for the commissioners in the court then to process the case in the way you need to do it.
And it's at least in some instances, the ALJ decision as ALJ is then, maybe with a few comments, adopted by David Schwartz, for example. That's the last
right.
one I looked at.
Yes. It would be possible for you to consider just adopting the referee's report.
And sometimes he makes modifications. He says, I take it, but not as to finding Z or as to this particular fact or this legal conclusion, or he adds something.
Correct. And I worked with, if I may say so, not only administrative people like David Schwartz, but with the boards, medical board, real estate board, et cetera. And they would often adopt the decision as written or make a minor modification to it.
That's what I'm thinking about. But then you need good reports and a uniform in how they're set up, or relatively uniform. You can't have absolute uniformity.
I don't think that's a goal you actually want.
No, that's right. Because how it's set up differs from issue to issue and case to case.
Exactly. I just remembered one other thing. In addition to the training, there does exist a bench book of sorts for referees, which I had a hand in drafting.
That's right. Where is it now?
Well, it still sits in sort of paperback form. It hasn't been reviewed or updated in probably 8 years. And that would be another resource for referees to be provided at training and also just to be available. And I think that may have been what Judge Kinney referred to partly when he said he referred to the material. But
I had forgotten that, but now it brings back those memories. How much work do you think it would take to update it and then put it online? Putting online wouldn't be hard, I don't think. How much work would it take to update it?
I don't like answering questions like that off the cuff.
Well, what you do,
and it's always more than you expect.
Mr. Schweitzer, is what I was going to say. Give a healthy estimate and then double it, and you may come close.
Always double it.
Exactly.
It depends partly on whether you're talking the number of hours that are required to write it or the number of weeks it takes to coordinate among the committee. I'm not trying to be facetious, but, two full weeks spread out over 3 months, and I don't know whether that needs to be doubled. If we had a small committee of two or three
done
people.
Done in my lifetime, in other words.
That would be in your lifetime.
All right.
Mr. Schweitzer,
any questions?
I've heard your comment about the additional training. Given the fact that you are the longest-serving referee, I am interested in hearing, just as I asked Mr. Dietrich, if you could make one or two changes to improve the overall system, what would they be?
I have not come with any ideas for changes. I don't think these changes are necessary. I don't, in my work with OLR over the past few years and prior to that with what was called BAPR, I thought the process worked quite well. I could think about it and I could give you more thoughtful answer after time. The answer is no. I don't feel that the system has to be changed.
Okay. Thank you.
Am I correct? I'm not sure I'm the longest serving, but I'm up there. Any other questions?
Say you are, sir.
Pardon me?
If we say you are. All right.
Thank you. I accept the honor.
It's my impression that you teach an ethics course at the law school. Is that right?
When I was here a month ago or so, I presented that. I am an adjunct at UW Law School, and I teach one section. Next semester is going to be two sections of PR.
I'm wondering if there would be some way to structure a course at the law school that would permit law students to help in the revision of the bench book that you talked about.
Thank you for the suggestion. My immediate reaction is it would take more time to teach them what was needed than they would help, as happens with many interns.
Yeah.
But, one could think of it. Or I could try to find a student or someone who would assist in that.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, thank you. Can I ask and answer any other questions? Thank you very much.
And thank you for your work as referee, and we look forward to your doing the bench book. Does anyone else wish to appear in favor or opposed to this petition? Mr. Salini? Do you have any additional comments? I'm sorry. Judge Murphy, Referee Murphy. Absolutely. Take the podium. A welcome back.
Keith, excuse me for the casual attire. Elizabeth and I were going bowling after we left here this morning, but it's not. Just a couple of quick comments. I can appreciate where OLR is coming from and trying to make the system a bit more efficient, but I don't see going to a panel of four reserve judges as a way to do that. As some of the things that have been said here today, I do believe would help. One, for example, I would think that the panel doesn't need to be 32 people in size. It seems a bit unwieldy, especially if there's individuals on that panel who rarely, if ever, are doing any referee work. So right there, by narrowing down the group, I think would be helpful. But however it plays out, my personal belief is that panel should contain attorneys as well as judges. It's true that as a judge, I'm pretty proficient in running procedures in a courtroom. I know how to do that. I've done it long enough, and I think I was fairly good at it. But there's more to being a referee than just managing the proceeding in a courtroom. In this case, not in a courtroom, but in the hearing room, wherever it might be. It could be the Paper Valley Motel, where I have a hearing coming up next month. But there's more to it than that. I'm not only the one who's running the show. I'm the trier of fact. And I think we need to have people who are willing to take on that role, which is a different role from what circuit judges often play. We have juries to try the facts in the tough cases when they go on to be contested. That's not true for referees. Referees have to make those hard choices, not only about the procedural matters, but they have to make hard choices as well as about what's going to happen to this attorney. And I think, as Dean pointed out, for example, his concern when somebody calls for representation is, are they considering suicide? I believe that. I have talked to these people during the status conferences and scheduling conferences we have, and most of them are pro se. I understand they're lawyers, but they're pro se and they're upset. I mean, their livelihood, their reputation in the community, some of these folks come from fairly small towns where there's five or six lawyers practicing. This gets out. There's a lot at stake here, and they really are terribly confused about what's going on. And I can't just sit back and say, oh, you're a lawyer, you understand all this. They're not thinking like lawyers at that stage of the proceedings. They're just thinking as human beings who are in a lot of trouble. So I think whatever we can do with whatever group you're going to use to do this, I think you have to pick people who are capable of looking at that side of things as well, the side that requires the involvement in not just making sure your hearing runs well and the proper evidence gets admitted or not admitted, but that decisions can be made that are fair and just. And I think one thing that can help to accomplish that is keeping the panel involved with both attorneys and with judges. Another thing I would suggest, if I have an opportunity to suggest, is change the rule on the plea bargaining. So many of these people that I talk to on the phone, they would love to be able to talk to the OLR attorney, whether it's private counsel or somebody from Keith's staff, about working something out. I mean, they're willing to admit what they did. They're willing to do whatever you tell them to do, but they don't know how to get to that point. And I can't really suggest anything. I don't feel it's my role to involve myself in trying to suggest to OLR this or that. I have on occasion suggested to the respondents that if they would enter a plea, then the only issue before me and then ultimately before you would be the punishment, and that might be a way to deal with it. I can't tell them it's a good idea or a bad idea. I can only suggest that they might consider that. And they're always asking, well, can I talk to OLR? And the OLR staff person or attorney, rather, is always telling them, I'm sorry, I can't really sit down and talk to you about these things. I can't negotiate something with you. Well, having been in a jurisdiction where we did lots of criminal law and lots of everything, I mean, in Sheboygan, we took what came in the door. And, you know, we did parking tickets to murders. And in the criminal area, I can tell you without plea bargaining, I don't know what in the world we would have done. And I think that's true of everybody in the state who's involved with criminal law in the judicial system. And I don't see why the OLR can't do that. I don't think it diminishes the process, and I think it would add much to the ability to really get a fair result. I realize the public perception of all of this is we're all in this together. It's a whitewash. You know, we're just looking out for the lawyers all the time. I've never experienced anything like that. I know it's not true. So if we do something a little different, I don't know that the public perception is going to change one way or another in terms of how the whole system works. Our key responsibility is to make the system work in a fair way. And these people are litigants. They're before us, and they're as confounded by the whole process as criminal defendants tend to be, at least the first time they're in court, not the tenth time. They kind of get the hang of it by that time. But initially, I think most lawyers are going to only experience this sort of thing once in their life, and it's a pretty tough time for them. And anything we could do, I think, to make the system be fair, but still sufficiently fair to both sides, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It has to work. We have to protect the public and our profession and what we do, but we also should be cognizant that these are people who are not just, you know, robots that are being processed through some system. They're human beings and have real concerns about what's happening to them. And as I said, I can tell you quite honestly, they don't really have a clue, even though they're lawyers. So that's how I feel about that.
Thank you.
Judge, first, thank you for your service, and thank you for sticking around and foregoing or at least postponing the trip that you and your wife had planned. And I appreciate it. I've been listening very closely to your comments. And even though you've already somewhat answered the question, is there anything else that you see in your experience and observations that could lend itself to the overall improvement of the system?
Well, I know there was some discussion here just a moment ago about adopting findings. I think the court basically already does that. I mean, if you look at most of the decisions, and I'm sure you're more cognizant of this than I am, really the issue comes down to the discipline part of it. I mean, I'm the trier of fact, and you're probably not likely to overrule factual decisions that I make any more than you're likely to overrule a jury decision. But you are concerned about my recommendation in terms of discipline. And I've certainly, you've come up with different things than I would have, and that's perfectly fine. But I think the focus of the court in this whole process is probably more on the discipline area than it is on the actual procedural part of it, because you're not going back and rehashing all the witnesses and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not sure that a big change is necessary there. Mostly I think it's a matter of making those tough calls. Are they revoked? Are they suspended? Or whatever. You know, those are the tough things that have to be done. I would be willing, if John is interested in working with him on getting the bench book back up and in place. Just keep in mind that I have to go to Arizona in January, and I can't return until April due to weather conditions here. I would be available, though, when I came back. If John is interested, I'd be more than happy to help out.
And I'm assuming you'd be available by telephone.
Of course.
And Internet in Arizona.
Oh, yes, we have to Skype with my granddaughter every occasion.
Well, you'd love Skyping with John Schweitzer.
I'm sure.
Your comments, which I really appreciate, and welcome to Dane County as a resident of Dane County.
Thank you. I've been down here 4 years now.
And there is at least one jurisdiction, I'm sorry, I can't remember which one, that uses a referee, but also uses one or two other people to sit with the referee and make Keith is shaking his head affirmatively, so I'm not making this totally up. I must have read it somewhere. It reminded me of the civil code system where you have a professional judge and you've got two lay people all three sit together. And they therefore add their expertise as the professional judge of running the machinery and as finding a fact, but then you get the input of a lawyer, and I can't remember who the third person was, whether it was a public member or was another lawyer, et cetera. But what do you think of that? I know it's nothing we've had experience with, so it's a little strange.
It sounds very French to me.
Yeah, it's the French, right. But you can do it in English.
Right.
Enough said.
It is part of the French legal system. That is how they do proceed. But in other civil code, Napoleonic code systems do use that. Actually, I did something like that recently in I do some construction arbitration, and I did it. I was a legal person, and then we had two construction experts.
Mm-hmm, that's right. It's the same kind of thing.
I'm not sure. I mean, if you're talking about having two lawyers there, I'm not sure it adds much to the whole process. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling it might even overwhelm the respondent even more to have all these. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's very nerve-wracking for respondents when they get to the point of having open hearings is that it is an open hearing. And I've had some experience where they've been very concerned when they found out that people can actually come in the room and sit there and listen to what's being said about them. I don't know if they don't think that's going to happen, but, it is.
I think that the cases are generally tried okay by the OLR because we heard a letter that indicated great criticism.
No, I don't have any criticism of the decisions. Other than the fact that I think OLR's hands are tied by their, and Keith, I think, expressed this very well, they just don't feel they're in a position to really negotiate not only with somebody like Dean or, Claude Cavelli or somebody else who does this kind of work pretty routinely, they can't even negotiate with the respondent. And I think the OLR sometimes charges a lot of stuff, and I think it looks like on the surface like they're overcharging. But I don't sense that's true because these are all independent violations. And I know DAs do that because they want a plea bargain and they're going to take half of it off the table. And maybe that's OLR's problem. They charge everything out because they feel that's their brief really is to look at the ethical rules. And if they violated an SDR, well, then they charge them. Because how do you pick amongst the things as which ones are important and which not? That also reminds me, too, they're often dealing with not only one or two or three different people who are clients, and these clients are all expecting their problems to be taken care of, too. You know, you can't say, okay, forget clients three and four that you screwed up on. Right. We're only going to deal with one, two, and three. But I think they have to have some flexibility within that, just like DAs do. They often get faced with that same dilemma of how to reduce charges in a way that doesn't tell the victims of the case, we don't care about you. It's a tough call, but it can be done, and I think it would make the system much more efficient if that was possible. But OLR can't do that. So if they charge out 60 violations, unless I dismiss them, or OLR outright dismisses them themselves, and I have done that. I mean, I've had motions in cases involving where there are attorneys involved where they'll move to dismiss, and I'll dismiss because I can tell there's insufficient evidence to go through the final hearing and have a finding, and I will do that and narrow the thing down. And OLR office will do exactly the same. I think when things, I know Dean was mentioning a little bit about where you want to give them new information. My experience is when OLR, not at the committee level, but at OLR level, when they get new facts, they do act on those facts, and they will take that charge and say, well, that witness is we see that witness is no longer reliable. She's recanted her previous statement or deposition or whatever it was, and then they'll just dismiss those counts. So I don't. It's not like they're locked into this thing. But without the plea bargaining, I think it makes it a little more difficult to cut those number of charges down.
And unless they bring the charge to the PRC, then they can't have trouble adding it later.
They do. Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. Yeah, that's a whole different setup, because it's like going to this grand jury and then saying the grand jury, once done, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, it's like a super grand jury system, really, in a way. It's kind of different even where they have grand juries. I know Dean's concerned that defense counsel doesn't get much say in front of the PRC, but the PRC being like a grand jury, well, defendants don't get a say in front of grand juries in states that use them. They just sit there and get to listen to the proceedings. Here, the only equivalent we have is a John Doe, and it's the same sort of setup then.
Well, anything? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Does anyone else wish to appear? Keith? I do have a question about substitution, if you know offhand. Frequent, infrequent, percent?
Infrequent, but I do not know the percent.
Infrequent.
I would have to research the percent.
But not frequent.
That's correct, Chief.
That was my impression from the papers I signed. All right, thank you. Anyone else have any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear on 1304? If not, I will call a close to the hearing of 13-04 in the matter of the petition for amendment of rules relating to referees and lawyer regulation system. I will now call our next dual petition 13-05 in the matter of the petition to establish procedure for enforcement of Supreme Court disciplinary orders. Mr. Celine, you are the presenter. While you're approaching the podium, I have no other appearances for 1305. Is there anyone who wishes to appear on that? Mr. Celine.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Petition 1305 has been submitted to the court in response to its request and a disciplinary case, disciplinary proceedings against Lister, in which the court enforced its order to pay restitution. There had also been a case in about that time frame, disciplinary proceedings against Lister, where the OLR filed a motion to enforce the court's conditions for assistance and monitoring under the Lawyer Support and Monitoring Program. The proposal that OLR has presented to you is one that we believe is essentially codifies the procedure that the court has been using in these kind of situations. And I do want to note that it was also supported by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Board of Administrative Oversight. The purpose of the petition is to provide an enforcement procedure, and the purpose of the petition does not go beyond that. I think we recognize that a lawyer's failure to follow the court's conditions in a disciplinary order might also be a reason to initiate another disciplinary proceeding. Certainly that could incur either in lieu of or in addition to an enforcement proceeding. On the other hand, the enforcement of the court's orders in these cases is in the public interest in and of itself. Obviously, the court imposes the conditions and issues the order because it has seen fit to do so in the public's interest. And it follows from that enforcement of that order would also be in the public's interest. In Wisconsin, like any other state, when a court issues an order to any individual, any citizen, or any person under its jurisdiction, the violation of that order can be brought to the attention of the court in a variety of ways. But the fact of the issuance of the order gives that court the inherent authority to seek cause for why the order would not be followed. Hence, it might be done in a situation where the lawyer or the other person would not even know of the existence of the order, and that would be clarified in the process. It might be done simply because the person has neglected to comply with the order without any particular intent. And so the same, and this should be the standard in this kind of case. Even in the ethics rule, Supreme Court Rule 20:3.4c, a lawyer may be found to have committed an ethical violation on the standard of knowingly failing to obey a court order. And there is no willfulness required by that ethics rule.
I forgot to look it up, but is willful defined differently than intentionally in this code?
I would have to refer to the definitions. I don't recall.
I did not do that. But sometimes I found some of the comments seem to use those two terms the same, but I thought that they were different or potentially different. And I didn't. I was sort of careful about what they were.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Pardon me?
I did not mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, that's all right. I'm sort of mumbling while I found the definition section. But go ahead.
The willful standard that we have in Supreme Court Rule 2203 sub 4 for a lawyer's non-cooperation with OLR's notice of investigation or request for information involves a slightly different situation because that is a circumstance where there is not a court order. And it's I think, an important distinction to make in terms of the enforcement. The fact that OLR is seeking the information and not a court, I think, justifies a different standard there, a higher standard, willful, than what is required for an enforcement of a Supreme Court disciplinary order. On the other hand, with regard to the process, our experience under Supreme Court Rule 2203 sub 4, I think, is very instructive and helpful to you. That rule was created and made effective in October of 2000. We have had over 13 years of experience with motions for temporary suspension for non-cooperation. These have been provided in the form of a motion and affidavit, and the court has issued orders to show cause in appropriate circumstances and has been able to resolve those without any difficulties. And I'm not aware that there have been any significant problems that have arisen as a result of using that procedure, even though the lawyer's interests in this case are quite significant. And I know that the court is also aware that those motions are not filed unthinkingly and that they are not continued when the cooperation occurs. I'm sure know that when the motion is filed, sometimes the lawyer at that point, having received notice of our motion, decides to cooperate and the motion is promptly withdrawn. In other circumstances, the lawyer's cooperation will occur immediately after the court issues the order to show cause. And sometimes it is after the court issues the suspension order, and sometimes never is there cooperation that comes forward. But in all of these cases, OLR has worked very well with the court to make sure that the court was promptly apprised of any response from the lawyer and that motions were withdrawn or dismissed in response to the lawyer's cooperation. In addition, there hasn't been any concern that I'm aware of about the submissions that are made in support of the motion, that the affidavits that have been provided in these circumstances appear to it, from our perspective and our knowledge at OLR, to be adequate for the court to exercise good judgment in how to resolve these cases. And with that, I would be pleased to answer any questions I have.
Well, I was looking at the Lister case again. That sort of was tough to decide it, but it's easy to read it. I noticed Mr. Volke was the referee. Was he the referee in the original case, too?
I do not recall.
No, okay. Chief Justice, whether he was. And the issue here was Lister was ordered to pay restitution, right?
That's correct.
And it said that he was to pay within the time specified, unless he could show that he was unable to pay.
Yes.
And that he's suspended if he's not going to pay, right? And he didn't pay.
I'd have to go back and check. I think he may have responded to some extent.
Okay.
But I'm not sure of that right now.
But he may have paid but he didn't pay all of it, right?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to your question.
Okay.
I would have to check.
But the issue was you didn't bring another discipline action against him for violating the court order, which might have been done, but you wanted to... Pardon me?
That's correct. We have not.
Okay. And so the question... That's why the question in the case... was what procedure should be used to enforce this court order about his remaining out until payment was made. And it was further ordered that beginning in October 1, 2012, Lister shall make monthly payments in the amount of $500 unless he's financially unable. And that was what had to be done, and he was going to be out until it was repaid. I have much more problem on more difficult conditions. We've been imposing conditions for drug tests. We've been imposing conditions for mental health examinations. You probably can tell me better than I can the variety of conditions we've been imposing. But those are too generally stated. We might more specifically state you got to sign a contract with WISLAP, you got to adhere to the WISLAP rules, and then the drug test isn't taken. WISLAP rule is not adhered to, and then we have issues, and they're more complicated factually.
Yes.
And then they're more complicated as to what to do with them. And I gather from this that you would either do contempt, which has its own set of rules, right?
Yes.
And you'd comply with those set of rules?
Yes, that is an option.
Or you would fall under the order to show cause proceeding that you've set forth.
That's correct.
What about the comments, and I think they were by the commissioners, that they don't think you're giving enough due process? Now, that may be an unfair summary, but it's my summary at the moment.
The petition gives the due process, I think, that I don't know how it could give more due process. I think it's a question of the form of the affidavit supporting the motion and the legal standard to be applied with which OLR disagrees with the commission.
Okay, the due process is you're giving notice. They get an opportunity to respond.
Right. Before the court, and then the court would issue the order, they would respond. And then the court can then review that essentially as it would review pleadings or it would review something that would be presented in the motion for a temporary suspension for non-cooperation, although some of these are going to be more complex. So typically, a non-cooperation matter would not go to a hearing, but where there are factual concerns or there are matters that OLR has asserted with which the respondent attorney disagrees, factually that are relevant such that a factual determination should be made, then the provisions that we have here provide for a hearing. And at that hearing, the respondent attorney would have the opportunity to, first of all, contest what OLR present whatever information, again, under the rules of evidence and civil procedure that apply, under the guidance and the direction of the referee.
A question has arisen. That sounds like a passive voice, doesn't it? A question about due process. Specifically aimed at due process according a right of appeal after the matter may have been referred to a referee. Okay. And in our Lesueur opinion, it could be interpreted that there is no right of appeal.
The rule as proposed does not provide for an appeal. Do you think that there should be an appeal? Does due process require an appeal from the referee? Is there an opportunity for reconsideration, if not appeal? What are your thoughts, if any, regarding the lack of appeal process from the referee's determination in the proposed rule?
Thank you, Justice. I don't think that certainly would not have any objection to providing that right and amending subparagraph 3 to include the paragraphs that provide for review and appeal. So change the reference to 2216 to include 2217, for example. There would be no objection to that from OLR, certainly. And it may have been just something that we did not think through sufficiently on the belief that the court, having seen the order and able to review, and obviously will review it, would be able to order briefs if it thought it was necessary or not, or to review it on its own.
I'm going to play my hand, so to speak, in this, and I think of due process as the process that is due, and I'm get awfully frustrated with some of these continuing cases. LeSueur is an example. And when I say get awfully frustrated, I'm not saying getting awfully frustrated with you. I think the dynamics of an enforcement, when there are conditions like get a urine sample, sign all the necessary releases, cooperate with treatment, get a practitioner's report, generally psychiatric or psychologist, a report, and submit it quarterly to OLR, those kinds of conditions, which we are putting on in an increasing amount, leads me to conclude, as I play my hand, that I have concerns that we're going to get sucked into establishing a system that we wish we didn't have. That it reminds me of child support hearings. And that is, you know, you're trying to get money. You know, you're trying to get them to comply with certain conditions. And the dynamics of life, sometimes the dynamics of dysfunction, just don't allow a court, especially an appellate court, who is best suited to, as we did this week maybe, to decide issues of insurance construction or issues of constitutional proportion. We're not all that equipped to be like a child support court here. Those are my concerns. It's kind of an overarching concern.
Right.
Could you respond to my concern?
I'd be happy to. Lawyer discipline is one of those unique areas where this Supreme Court, appellate court, does things that are like a trial court. And the reason you have to use referees is because you just cannot practically accomplish all those tasks. You cannot conduct trials in these cases. And I think the tendency that this court has had over the last 12, 13 years that I've been here is to become increasingly interested in the situations where there are conditions. In restitution, there's been an increase of interest in restitution. The lawyer support and monitoring program has been of tremendous value already. It will prove itself 10, 20 times more as we go forward. But it's the court's interest in this that has put us in this situation where we are. It's a response by the court to the public's interest in these cases. Mm-hmm. So my first response to you, Justice, would be that this work must be done. The question then arises, by whom must it be done? And it may not be that the Supreme Court should be bothered with these issues, but then there would have to be authority delegated to some appropriate person to make those ultimate decisions, enforcement decisions, which traditionally are done by the court itself enforcing its own authority. And appellate courts don't do this very often, so it's somewhat unique. So it
Who
is
does
possible.
It? Who does it in other courts?
In appellate courts? The only enforcement I see would be enforcement of its own orders, and they typically relate to the litigation and the occurrences, the orders issued in the process of the appeal. But appellate courts generally are not issuing those, you know, orders of suspension for lawyers or other, like family support orders, you know. So it's just a different phenomenon. This program requires the Supreme Court to take on actions that a trial court would normally do, and we do it through our agents. So so there would have to be a delegation, or there would have to be a decision not to do these things, which are in the public interest, or to do them in a way that allows us to do them as efficiently as possible, which is what we've been trying to do together.
You hit the nail on the head in understanding my concern. Court commissioners provided us with a memo, and I smile because at the top of one page is, this is not the opportunity to in-depth discuss the lawyer support and monitoring program. And I understand that, but nevertheless, I will go where angels may fear to tread. And that is this program, a program that I am a big fan of because I think it can really make a difference in the lives of the practitioners in this state and enhance the protection of the public also at the same time. You commented that it has the opportunity to reap success many-fold, and I think that's true. A consequence of this program that's now been in existence for 3 years is that with greater frequency, we are imposing conditions on the practice of law. I note, because also on our agenda for later today is a review of Rule 08-28, which is a review of the lawyer support and monitoring rule, and we have, of course, a report that was submitted and in color, which was kind of fun to read. Note that in one of the charts that indicates compliance rate, and this program is new, and we're dealing with a difficult population in some ways. But the chart reflects 58% active cases, and then a total of 36 that were all refused or dropped out or pending dropouts or terminated, and 6% thus far successful completion.
Right.
I don't use these numbers to say only 6% because for a variety of reasons. But in my mind, I use these numbers to suggest there's a lot of the 36% of termination, dropout, pending dropout indicates a bit of noncompliance to me. And are those non-compliances going to end up on our lap? And I think that they likely, many of them, will end up on our lap to decide whether or not Attorney Smith, who signed the releases but didn't date them, after being asked 3 times... And all of this time, we're involved, we're getting memos, didn't sign it this time, oh, now he came in and signed it, but he didn't date it, and he did sign it, he did date it, but he sent it back, we asked him for 2 weeks, and it came back, of course, not in 2 weeks, but in 4 weeks. What do we do with that? As a court, as a Supreme Court dealing with all of this stuff.
What you will see in the report on the monitoring program is that 10 of those situations are referrals by OLR.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, there's a large number of self-referrals.
I'm sorry. Interestingly, there's a large number of what?
Self-referrals. Voluntary
right.
referrals. Mm-hmm. The voluntary referrals are not matters that would be subject to an enforcement petition because there's nothing there.
Sure.
In the cases of a diversion agreement, and I think one of these that were referred was the subject of a diversion agreement, one of the 10. When there is noncompliance, then those are enforced through the provision of Rule 22.10, which says the director will give notice and after receiving a response may terminate or modify the diversion and proceed as otherwise authorized by the rules if terminated. So that is a situation that would not come before the court unless there had been a disciplinary proceeding after PRC finding of cause and the process there. So it would only be in the cases where the Supreme Court has issued orders relating to a monitoring situation that would be coming back to you in the enforcement procedure, and that's going to be a small percentage of these cases.
Small percentage, but this is not exhaustive. 2013, Wisconsin 42, Stephen Compton continued to participate in WISLAP monitoring program for 2 years. That's a recent one. Maria Schreier, 2013, Wisconsin 35, 6 months suspension, abstinence from all alcohol and mood-altering substance, abstinence from over-the-counter medication that contains alcohol or mood-altering substance, regular participation in a community-based support group such as AA, and the list goes on. My point is we are doing this with greater frequency, and that is exacerbated or increased because of this very good program. I think that we are going to be facing with greater frequency these non-compliance situations. And I think, and my concern is that we are going to start drowning, that's an exaggeration for emphasis, but become consumed with some of these because these are the types of cases that don't go away.
I don't know that anyone knows the frequency at which these might be brought to your attention. I can tell you from my work with the State Bar Program that the minor occurrences where something goes wrong, where someone does not abstain, someone misses a meeting with a monitor, they don't result in the automatic termination from the program. Ms. Albert understands how these work, and she knows that failure is part of success in these processes. And so the matters do not come back to OLR until there is a substantial demonstration of noncompliance. And it essentially means the lawyer is either unable or unwilling or both to do what is required, and it could be either or both. And in the Lesueur case that the court had decided on this matter, you could see from the record in that case the efforts to which the WISLAP program went in order to try and promote it. The efficiency here and the motivations here for those of us who are working with in this program are to use the court as a last resort because it will take us longer to achieve our objective there than if we try to do it through negotiation or reminders with the individuals and to remonstrate with them more. So the example you gave of the release that's signed and not dated, you know, the issue with the WISLAP program, the issue with our office is can we move forward to accomplish what the court has told us to do? And if we can, that's easy. We don't need to bother you to do what we can do on your behalf. And the situation will arise from time to time where we cannot. And that's when they'll be made. In some cases, you're going to find, like with the temporary suspension motions, that first of all, before you even know about it, the communication with our office with that particular attorney says, this is where we are now. We need some help because we don't have the authority to issue an order or to impose any sanction for violating the court's order, but we see that you're not. And so we will need to go to the court. That may be enough to induce compliance. If it's not and the motion is filed, again, there's a step at which that compliance may occur because they know it's coming. And it may go through the entire gamut. It may even go beyond in the case. It may even go beyond the issuance of the court's enforcement order. That's entirely foreseeable in these situations. But we think that if the court continues to do what it has done, and continues to enforce the orders that it determines are in the public interest. And using the procedure that you used in the Lister and the Lesueur cases, once it is clear that the court will take appropriate action in appropriate cases, then I think that there will be a beneficial impact on this entire process. So it will be, to some extent, self-healing in the effect that when lawyers understand in that situation that there is precedent for the court making decisions to enforce its orders under these circumstances, that there will either be compliance or will be in a situation where it's not, there will be nothing more that can be done. In some circumstances, in monitoring for an alcoholism or a drug dependency or a medical incapacity or depression, the relationship between that concern and the significant harm that happens to clients, other people in our state, is dramatic. It's dramatic. And we know that, you know, there are about 10% of us in America who have an impairment of some sort, depression or dependency or both, and at least 20% of the legal profession. There was a Johns Hopkins study I saw 2 weeks ago that said 36% of us have it. When we look at the cases that come into OLR, if they're dismissed at intake or after formal investigation, if there's a diversion, private, public reprimand, we don't see 10%. We don't see 36% of a correlation. We see 1%, 2%, 10% at the most. But where we have suspensions, where we have revocations, you know, we're seeing 1 in 3, 1 in 2, and it's probably greater than that in reality because of what we cannot perceive. So if we don't enforce these orders, or if we take a longer time to go through the normal disciplinary process to do that, it's more likely that more people are going to be hurt in massive numbers, massive numbers. Now, there are cases within the last couple of years where lawyers were disciplined and with grievances in the dozens, and one person had over 60 of them, and he was medically incapacitated. He kept taking clients' money, and away he went. And people who were giving him money had no idea that no work would ever be done, and they were going to lose those funds. But he needed money, and it was the right thing for him to do in order to preserve his own interests. But in these situations where it's going to be most difficult for the court, it's also going to be the most important.
Most important, did you say? Would you say? Well, you know, we're getting it at both ends. We have conditional admission. So this person's admitted conditionally, and then there's a breach of that condition.
Yes.
And then the question is, what do we do then? How do we enforce this conditional admission? Then we get it at the other end, where somebody has been disciplined, conditioned, and now the condition is breached. So we're seeing an attempt to assist counsel and allow the practice, subject, of course, to public safety, and then just increases the number of matters that come before you, come before BB, and then come before the court. Now, again, looking at the commissioners, recollection is correct. They're the only ones that responded other than your response to ours. One, they think we should put in the words willful, and I notice in LeSueur, the court used the word willful. Do you agree?
No, I don't, Chief
Pardon
Justice.
Me?
I don't agree with that.
Okay, why not? I tell you that the court did use the word willful and
yes.
And LeSueur.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I think the standard should not be more than a knowing violation, and the standard.
Willful is not defined. Intentional is not defined. Knowing is defined.
Knowing is defined. It should not be greater than a knowing violation, and it probably should be a knowing violation. It's foreseeable that a negligent failure to violate the Supreme Court's order might also be appropriately sanctioned and remedied. It is possible that that should also be true. And as I mentioned early in my remarks, you know, any person subject to an order of this court has an affirmative duty to obey it, and lawyers more than members of the public. The ethics rule, 20:3.4c, has a knowing standard. So imposing a willful standard or an intentional standard, whichever, would actually have a higher standard for providing the motion and enforcing your order and actually issuing a decision, finding a violation in a disciplinary case. It seems backwards to me. And it would seem to provide lawyers more protection than any member of the public would have.
The other comment of the commissioners was that the violation should be substantial, not technical or minor. And this goes back to the concept of, you know, discretion.
Yes.
So do you agree it should be substantial?
I do not believe that should be in the rule. I believe that the practical effect of the burden of bringing the motions and it being the least effective way for OLR to proceed makes it unnecessary. In addition to that, I know that the Supreme Court is going to exercise discretion in responding to that motion. Reading what it is, the court can very quickly say, in our minds, we're not going to issue it in order to show cause because this is not substantial in our view.
Well, would you agree? Do you think that then you have to bring to the court every single violation?
No.
Okay. So it would be your discretion as to which ones to bring?
Yes.
Okay. And you don't need substantial. The other comment, and if I'm missing any, I don't intend to, was that they want your, if I understood this, your pleadings to be more detailed, mm-hmm. and they want the respondent's response to be more detailed. What do you think about that? And I know you say that, well, you follow the rules of civil procedure here, but go ahead.
Right. What I would say, Chief, is that the experience we have under 2203 sub 4 with motions for suspension for non-cooperation has been adequate for our purposes to order suspensions of attorneys that are never reinstated, and it's worked very well for 13 years.
I know, but that's sort of one simple non-compliance, right? You send them the notice, you send it by whatever is required, registered mail, certified mail, return receipt, first class mail. You did it four times or 10 or whatever number you do it. They got one or more of these communications. You got none back. The end. I mean, that's usually a two-pager.
It is generally a short affidavit. But I think the affidavit would still have to provide adequate facts mm-hmm. to convince the court that there has been a violation. So it's not that the affidavit wouldn't have to be longer that is problematic. I don't think that the affidavit should have to contain admissible evidence. It seems like something that is not related to the process of pleading, but instead would relate to the process of a hearing. When thinking about the rules of evidence, we think about what is admissible at a hearing. Obviously, everything in the affidavit is hearsay, and I don't think that we should be looking at the technical aspects of making these decisions about whether something is admissible evidence or not. We should be looking at the substance of the allegations that are made and the substance of the response from the lawyer and then making a determination about whether evidence should be required, in which circumstance it ought to go to a referee to make factual findings.
You know, I am concerned that what you are setting up here is trial within a trial within a trial. You know, you're here because some people don't comply with conditions in an order of this court, and you know, the focus is commendable. But then we have now another trial on that, and there's another order. And they don't comply with those conditions. I'm really wondering if, given the number of times we are now tending to put conditions that require a certain amount of supervision on our orders from a disciplinary matter, if we shouldn't have just a paragraph that goes in every decision that failure to comply with these conditions will result in a request in order to show cause why your license shouldn't be temporarily suspended, and just have it in there as an order. If they don't comply, all you have to do is submit an affidavit to the court. They haven't complied. An order to show cause will issue, and there can be a temporary suspension. I mean, I don't know why we don't treat it the same way we do under 23.03 sub 4 instead of creating a whole new process. Is there some reason you've chosen to go a different way?
I don't know. There is not. And I think if there was something in the original order that provided for that, I think that would be helpful to this entire process. The reason that that does not appear here is really because I had not thought about having that language in the order. And we have also done this through a motion from OLR in our experience in our past cases. So what I did was to draft what I thought would codify how the court has handled our recent cases.
So maybe we just need to look at the kinds of orders we're issuing when there are conditions that have to be monitored for the individual lawyer and kind of short-circuit this just a little bit with a new paragraph.
I'd like, do you have any response? Because I want to follow up.
I do. I think that would be beneficial, but I would want to make sure that we all understood that even when that happens and there's a self-executing language in the original court order, that there still ought to be due process for that lawyer, and it's going to have to occur in some form, which I know you agree with.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. We have due process in 2203 sub 4.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm looking at the same type of process, but, you know, I am concerned about having a process that now can refer things to a referee that can have more briefing, that can really become quite voluminous. And not that it couldn't occur with just a simple change in our order, but maybe we should look at a simpler way of solving the problem before we take a more complicated approach.
Yes. If we can, that would be helpful, and I think that's a good suggestion. There are going to be cases that are going to place the problem right back into the court's lap again, where it's going to have to do more than just look at the self-executing language, and they're going to have to sort out some factual disputes that are going to be raised in the course of the motion and the response. So we may be able to solve some cases more simply with that language, and I think, therefore, it's beneficial. But we will also have the kinds of cases that will require everything that's in this proposal, the entire process that's in this proposal, in some cases.
That was what my comment was going to be. I think that the language, putting it in order, may be a good idea. But again, in these cases that involve conditions for mental health issues and for substance abuse issues, that issuing an order to show cause why their license shouldn't be suspended will very well likely result in some kind of a contested hearing, or more likely to resolve in a contested hearing, because these are not here issues. 2203-4 is temporary suspension for failure to respond to the OLR investigation. We get those with some frequency, and they are often pretty cut and dry. We sent two letters, some certified, you know, nothing returned, everything returned, or whatever the affidavit says, and then because there have been multiple efforts and no response, then we issue an order to show cause. That's a little more difficult than did you knowingly not comply with this condition? It seems to me that right. We still are going to have a trial, although that may be of assistance, but we still are going to be having a trial or much more dispute because of the number of conditions and the enforcement mechanism. That's my sense. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think you're going to have more difficulty with the monitoring cases when they arise. I think you will, because of the nature of the condition of the respondent and the nature of the disease, particularly if it's an addiction. Depression is easy because it's not easy. I'm being facetious.
Yeah, yeah.
Depression is not easy, but you may have situations there where you just do not get a response at all, and there's nothing for you to do. And that's a case, again, where we are sympathetic to the lawyer, obviously, but we also have a heightened concern for potential harm to the public where that person is still licensed to practice. That's a very difficult situation to have to adjudicate. Other cases, other types of conditions are going to be easier to understand, assess. The facts are going to be more distinct and discreet. But when we're talking about monitoring, I think that the WSLAP program does a good job of managing that and trying to make that something that applies good judgment, but also documents information such that we can make some objective determinations from what is going on in that program. with regard to whether a person is complying, how we know they're complying, what are the data that we're looking for to see. You know, are they testing positive? Are they reporting for their random tests? Are they making the calls to see if they have a random test? Are they attending the meetings? Are we getting the report from the treatment provider? Those are objective things we can look at to see how something is going. What makes it difficult is that when there is noncompliance, then all the defense mechanisms kick in from someone who has an addiction, and it becomes very difficult then to sort out some of the things that are not objective. So I think to some extent the court will be okay with this, but I think in the main they're going to be much more difficult than many of the other issues you see. But then again, they're also going to be the most important.
You know, I think we're all affected by our experiences of life, and you say some of these things are going to be objective. Did they report to the AA meeting or they didn't?
Right.
My experience in life tells me oftentimes they're going to be saying, well, I tried to, but I couldn't get a ride because I don't have a license.
That's right.
And then I started to, and I borrowed my neighbor's car, but then they, you know, my horse died, my my dog died, you know what I mean.
Yes.
I mean, there's just a thousand of real life or quasi-real excuses, and it's not all so objective. It's not so did they or didn't they. That's so you issue an order to show cause, and this is the stuff we get back.
Right.
Yeah. I have some more specific questions, if I may. That is the contempt. You know that the commissioners have indicated that they would request that that any reference to contempt be deleted. And I understand that you're that's acceptable to you? Or do
it
I
is, Justice. Mm-hmm. It is.
Why?
Well, I think that the rule is clear, if you adopt this rule, that nothing in this rule would affect the court's inherent contempt authority. And to be quite frank with you, nothing in this rule would affect the court's inherent authority to enforce any of its orders.
So if you put in contempt or you don't put in contempt, it's the same. That's the point that you're making?
If Mayor, the commissioners make – I'm happy with it in or out. The commissioners made the point in their memorandum that it may cause confusion about the procedures that would apply.
Oh, you can add a comment that you use ordinary contempt procedures.
That would also be acceptable to OLR.
Yeah, I'm just trying to see what – so you would accept – you think contempt is there whether you put it in or you take it out. You could come in under a contempt.
Yes.
If you followed the rules for contempt.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
Well, wait a minute here. Is contempt imposed without a sort of a face-to-face meeting between the entity imposing the contempt and the person who's the subject of the contempt?
I am not an expert on that. I would defer to the commissioners who provided that in their memo. It's my understanding that the court can order contempt of its order where it does not occur in the presence of the court.
But it is a different proceeding than if it occurred in your presence.
What is the contempt authority? I mean, what would be the potential remedies?
The remedies might include a fine, which I believe this court may have imposed in the long past before my tenure. The remedy could be imprisonment, I believe, under the statute, but I don't know. I haven't researched it. But when I asked my colleagues in other states, there are some of them use contempt procedures under their court's inherent authority. And, for example, a lawyer who continues to practice after revocation and will not stop, the court might decide that a short imprisonment might be appropriate. I don't think we've ever done that in Wisconsin. I'm not sure it's appropriate to do it anywhere. But I think a fine would be a typical contempt finding. There are some – I read a case the other day in my office where an appellate court in Wisconsin had imposed a $50 fine for every day a brief was late, finding the lawyer had violated the order to submit the brief and imposed an enforcement or a contempt for failing to do so, and a $50 a day fine until it was fine, without the lawyer actually appearing before the court at all.
Could a referee impose incarceration?
I do not believe a referee can do that. And I don't think it would be appropriate for the referee to do that. And the referee has the powers of a civil trial judge, according to Chapter 22. But we typically do not, you know, I don't know that that would be appropriate for us to do. I don't know that that would include the inherent power, the inherent authority of a court, because while he has those powers, he is not a judge.
The contempt is for violating a court order.
Court order.
Does the referee issue a court order?
The referee will issue an order. And if you look at the Lesueur matter, when the motion was filed and the court ruled on that, the referee in that case did issue an order to have to sign the releases, I think, and to get an evaluation by an independent medical expert. And we relied on the general powers of a circuit judge to order the respondent to get an evaluation.
But as far as our court orders, if we issue an order, we have the right to issue an order to show cause why the person shouldn't be found in contempt for failing to comply with the order. That's not a stretch.
Right.
Then we have to have a hearing.
Then I think you would at least have to have I haven't studied the contempt procedure, so I don't know.
Chapter 785.
Thank you.
Another objection or comment is regarding costs. The proposed rule should clarify the court will follow the provisions of 22.24 in deciding whether to impose costs, say the court commissioners. And what's your position with regard to that?
OLR has no objection to having a reference to the cost rule and to the court following that policy for costs.
The commissioners also indicate that respondents should identify objections to charge of noncompliance with specificity and record support. I understand that you take a strong exception to this proposed addition. Can you tell me why?
I think it does a couple things. It is not a problem with the objections or the response being specific. There's not a problem with the form for numbered paragraphs. In my mind, there's a concern about evidence and providing something that is admissible evidence, because I think it will cause confusion, because lawyers will typically understand that as something that occurs at a hearing and not during a pleading process, and they won't know what it means. If you're asking respondents in particular to provide admissible evidence in a response, they don't have it. They can't do it. It doesn't make sense to respondent to know what to do. All they can tell them is what he can tell them. And if there's any documentation, it's not really going to be something. It could be something that the respondent has. Yes, I couldn't get to the meeting that day, but the lawyer's not going to be removed from the monitoring program for missing one meeting. I mean, there would be some work done before they would be even terminated from their program or brought back to us for enforcement. So there would not likely be the kinds of things that you haven't already seen in OLR's affidavit or any supporting materials that a respondent could provide.
Is there anything else that you would like to adopt from the commissioner's report or not adopt from the commissioner's report? I think between us, we covered the points made, but I don't want to omit any.
I can give you some specifics. I would tell you that I've already spoken with Commissioner Rich about which of these we would be agreeable to and which we would not, and I believe that she has that information, but I'm happy to take you through it if you like.
And I think for
us, that in some of a memo.
Lovely colored chart. I love these colors. And tab 6, that she went through line by line. I don't know if it's necessary, but others may want you to do that.
Media.
going to jump ahead with one additional question.
I do want to especially say I find this one interesting. The Supreme Court may assess the cost of the enforcement proceeding against the attorney and shall follow the provisions of 2224 and case law interpreting that rule in determining whether to assess costs. I usually just say in accordance with.
And I would agree that the sentence should end after SCR 22.24, and I believe I had mentioned that to Commissioner Rich.
Okay. Thank you. That's not part of it. All right.
Where is that?
It is, footnote 11. Okay. It's on page, tab 6, second page. OLR recommends phrase, and law interpreting, we do not make reference. Yes, we all just say in accordance with or pursuant to.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the assumption is the court will follow its rules. Last time I looked at the assumption.
Are violations in a WSLAP monitoring agreement that are not explicitly included in the Supreme Court order grounds for a motion under the rule?
No.
Give me an example.
If you look back at the sewer enforcement action, there were several items of noncompliance by the attorney that were not within the court's order. And that was one of the difficulties we had in that case and has resulted in some clarification in what we're asking the court to do in future cases. But we had to do some parsing out of things where we had a basis to proceed compared to some things we did not, because we had to make sure that the Supreme Court order required the attorney to do these things and not our office directive or not the WSLAP contract. So you will see then in a subsequent reinstatement proceeding, the Chavez reinstatement, where we were much more clear about the information, the specific orders that we were seeking from the court, which the court did attach as conditions to his reinstatement, to make it clear that we had everything we needed from the court in order to properly monitor the attorney in the future.
I note you mentioned the Chavez, and that's set forth, by the way, that order for the other members of the court on page 12 of the commissioner's memo. One of the things that order provided for is that Chavez will contract with WSLAP and shall comply to the best of his ability. Is that good language or not? I'm always concerned about satellite litigation. And what do you think about that?
I can see where that would be very difficult language to enforce, and we may want to modify how we phrase that.
Another thing I note by that order is in ordering conditions, we can, as a court, let's say suspend someone for, and I'll just pick a number, 5 months, and order that they get drug testing, see their psychiatrist, and cooperate with WSLAP, all of those things, or we can also say that as conditions of reinstatement that they have to do this. Now, what's the difference? The difference is maybe they don't care if they're reinstated.
That's right.
And if they don't care if they're reinstated, then they will not do those things. Let me be a little more clear. Let's say a person has no intention to practice law anymore. And if our order is issued that we are suspending you for 5 months and we are ordering you to do XYZ conditions according to WSLAP, and they don't do that, they could be subject to the processes you have set forth in this rule or contempt, right? We're ordering them to do that and they don't do it.
That's right.
That's one avenue. But normally the order is effective if there's a carrot at the end of the stick. Is that where you have carrots?
Yes.
There's a carrot out there, anyway. And that is, they want something. They want to get reinstated. But if they have no desire to reinstate, aren't we then just, depending on our wording, setting them up for possible contempt and possible enforcement when they have no desire, apparently, to ever practice law again? Am I making myself clear?
You are.
Okay.
And I'm happy that you've raised this concern. The five-month suspension case or anything less than 6 months suspension is kind of a difficult situation because of the short term. But OLR would prefer in cases of suspension, particularly 6 months or longer, that the conditions be conditions generally, not in every case, but that the conditions be conditions that are required to be met to be reinstated, rather than just conditions that are ordered. And I think it provides an economy to the court for concerns about enforcement. It communicates clearly to OLR that you do not want OLR to actively manage these conditions until such time as there is a petition for reinstatement. It definitely places the burden on the lawyer in this circumstance where it ought to be, and it is the best motivation for compliance for anyone who wants to be reinstated. It's perfect.
How about for people, let's say someone is, I'm going to pick an age that's beyond everyone in this courtroom, 95, and they say, I'm not going to practice law again, and so why should I jump through those hoops, right? And so it seems to me in those cases, you would want to order it on reinstatement rather than at the outset because they have no desire to follow up in an attempt to get there.
It seems to me
back.
To be a similar situation for as a suspension, because on reinstatement, they will have to show that they have done A, B, and C in that circumstance. I don't see that as substantially different. The one exception to this idea, where it's a good idea, there may be some conditions that the court would want imposed regardless of whether the lawyer ever seeks reinstatement. Restitution is a good idea for there. And so that might be something, but then the court's options at that point are still somewhat limited. And OLR, you know, I doubt would ever come to you and say, I'll throw someone in debtor's prison. Seems inappropriate to me, and I think it would be inappropriate to do that. I don't know what other leverage you have in that circumstance, and imposing a fine doesn't seem to be much help either in a contempt motion. So those are circumstances where we would certainly use the State Bar's fund. The fund can then try and collect on a judgment, and we can do some things outside of using the court process. But it may be an example where you would want OLR to try enforcing something before there's an effort at reinstatement. But in the main, your suggestion, I think, is something that we ought to do.
And until this rule is adopted or not adopted, what are you going to do, just follow what you've always done?
We're going to rely on the common law, Chief Justice.
In other words, contempt and under what it is, show cause. Right.
And we're going to cite Lister and a litany of cases where the court has done this very well.
And you've done this in response to our request that you do this and not just rely on the common law, as you so aptly put it. Okay, just checking. But I think that what has to be done is a careful consideration of how conditions are phrased. And this is in the OLR request for conditions, in the referee's recommendation for conditions, and in our statement of conditions, so that they say what we mean. We understand what they mean, and that the ease of their enforcement is considered. I mean, I don't know what all that means, but to the extent that we impose the same conditions, we ought to phrase them the same from one discipline action to another. My sense is we've got variety now that we may or may not have intended. Do you have that sense?
No, but I need to go back and look at those orders now, and I will do that so that we take care of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And my sense could be wrong. We haven't that many. We have a number.
Right. I need to go look at them and make sure that we're doing it right.
Are there any other questions or comments? Do you want to say anything else, Mr. Saleen?
I just want to thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. And Mr. Saleen, would you thank the board and the bar for their efforts and work in both of these rules petitions?
I will.
One in response to Mr. Rogan's committee and the other in response to this court. Thank you.
Thank you. I will.
Is there anyone else who wishes to appear with regard to Rule Petition 1305 relating to a procedure for enforcement of Supreme Court discipline orders? Hearing none, this concludes our hearing on Rule Petition 1305 and concludes our public hearings on two rules petitions today. We have an open rules conference on discussion of 1304, 1305, and a miscellaneous assortment of petitions. The court is adjourned from its public hearing. It will reconvene in its open rules conference mode in 10 minutes.